which is A24-0247, State versus Torres. Good morning, counsel. You'll both be given 15 minutes for argument, and the appellant will then have an opportunity of 5 minutes for rebuttal time. Before you begin your argument, please identify yourself and your client for the record. And with that, I'll turn it to counsel for appellant.
May it please the court, counsel, your honors. Good morning. My name is John Munnins, and I represent the appellant in today's case, Geraldo Torres. Given the circumstances proved at trial, there is a rational hypothesis that Mr. Torres never exercised dominion or control over the methamphetamine that was eventually located in the Suburban. Specifically, the circumstances proved at trial support a rational hypothesis based on the inferences of those circumstances that the methamphetamine likely belonged to the front passenger who likely ditched it underneath the seat, or was simply already in the Suburban prior to Mr. Torres ever entering. For those reasons, we respectfully request that this court reverse Mr. Torres's conviction for fifth-degree controlled substance crime. I want to start by just addressing briefly the standard of review here, because I think it gets a little muddled, particularly in the respondent's brief. The standard of review is a heightened scrutiny for circumstantial evidence, where this court first looks at the circumstances proved at trial and then independently considers the rational inferences that can be drawn from those circumstances. It's important to note that no deference is given to the fact finder when looking at these rational inferences, or in other words, if there are competing rational inferences, the ultimate question is simply to sustain a conviction. The circumstances proved must be consistent with a reasonable inference of guilt and inconsistent with any other rational hypothesis except for guilt.
Can I just ask a clarifying question about the standard review, and then you can continue. So does that mean, in the context of a bench trial like we have here, where the district court issued findings of fact, that we don't defer to those factual findings that are written in the district court's decision? We look to the evidence in the record, or how do we use the district court's findings, if at all?
I think the district court findings, we do have the advantage of having their findings. So I think to disregard them as a circumstance proved, for instance, you would have to find that the finding was clearly erroneous. However, I don't believe that this court is limited to looking only at the findings that the district court did. Maybe more specifically, if so long as there are consistent findings with the district court's findings in the record, things that happened in the body or the squad video, for instance, or other testimony, this court can certainly consider the record as a whole. Part of the standard is that you disregard inconsistent evidence with those circumstances proved. That usually comes up in issues such as credibility determinations, where if you have competing eyewitnesses, for instance, or in a situation like this, had Mr. Torres testified himself, that might present a situation where you could disregard some things that were in the record, inconsistent with the judge's findings in this situation.
Thank you.
So Mr. Mona, so I understand the scope of your argument here, do you acknowledge that the circumstances proved support the district court's finding of guilt here, but that there's also another rational hypothesis inconsistent with guilt? Is that, I mean, you're not arguing that the court erred in finding that they supported a finding of guilt. Your position, as I understand it, is that whether that's the case or not, there's another rational explanation inconsistent with that finding.
Correct. It doesn't matter if there is a rational finding of guilt. And actually, the state actually notes a case, Bernhardt, I believe, is the one that they cite in their brief, where the Supreme Court discusses that case is an aiding and abetting case. And there's a dissent there. And the Supreme Court says, look, the dissent gives us a rational theory of guilt. That's fine. But that doesn't preclude the rational theory inconsistent with guilt, which is why it gets reversed. And so that's what we have here. You can take whatever circumstances you want and say, hey, looking at these, it looks as though Mr. Torres, knew about this methamphetamine and perhaps possessed it. Even if that's true, even if that's the case, the circumstances proved are simply inconsistent with a theory of guilt. We can look at the fact, for instance, if we compare these facts to Harris and Sam, probably the most distinctive difference between Harris, Sam, and Mr. Torres's case is that the officers observe this reaching motion by Mr. Torres, and they describe it as
Mr. Mullins, before you get into that, I wanted to follow up with my colleagues both asked because it's an intriguing question. In my years on the district court in a court trial, I don't recall ever using the heightened standard because the fact finder doesn't have to unless and until a district court has a motion of acquittal. And so I'm taking it from your argument, you're reading essentially the district court's order similar to a jury of addressing only the first step in the heightened standard of review, because that's all the district court would need to do unless and until there's a motion of acquittal at the end of the state's case. Is that correct?
That's correct. And that's, you know, Sam would be on point with that point, Your Honor, that if you have that motion of acquittal, they would have to use the heightened scrutiny. The district court here issued its findings of fact, conclusion of law, and order. And as you note, I think kind of only did the first step here of, is there a theory consistent with guilt? And that's what they found. But where the district court's, you know, verdict ends up being a failure is that there are circumstances here which present a theory inconsistent with the guilt of Mr. Torres. Again, as I was saying, I mean, I think probably the biggest distinction between Sam and Harris and Mr. Torres's case is that the officers in this situation did observe Mr. Torres reach, they describe it as down and to the left. So the state's theory is that apparently when he did that reaching, it would have been him placing this methamphetamine underneath his seat or in some way exercising dominion or control over it. Again, you know, even if that is a rational inference, we actually have a far more rational inference, frankly, because we know what Mr. Torres did when he was in that car. He grabbed a beer and drank a beer. And we know that there were beers sitting in bags just over to his left. And the officer who describes the motion even describes it as though he is digging in a bag. He did dig in a bag to get out a beer and drink a beer before he was arrested on his DOC warrant. It's a more than rational inference, given the circumstances there. And doesn't demonstrate any exercise of dominion or control over the items underneath his seat. And I think, you know, it's important to note that both Sam and Harris, the courts do not consider those to be very close cases, although I think there are some significantly more damning facts, particularly in Harris, which are far more incriminating against Mr. Harris than anything against Mr. Torres. Mr. Harris was the driver of the vehicle when it was stopped. The firearm that was located in Mr. Harris's was just above his head, slightly to the rear, but over the driver's seat. He had actually failed to stop when officers initiated the stop and gone on for several blocks before pulling over. The officers actually had to pull up next to the car and kind of force it to the curb. And the officers saw movement throughout the car before pulling it over by everyone. The court there notes that there was no specific testimony as to where the movement was or whether or not it was towards the firearm. And there again, too, when the officers look into the car, they immediately see from outside the car, they immediately see the butt of a firearm sticking out through the headlining of the vehicle. This is all makes it very apparent. Mr. Harris is closer to the item. He failed to stop. There was, you know, movements within the car. The firearm is clearly visible. It's the butt of the gun. And there was DNA evidence even that there was a mixture of DNA, five or more people, and 75% of the world's population could be excluded. And the state's theory there was that Mr. Harris, along with at least one or more of the occupants of that vehicle, jointly possessed the firearm when they hit it in the headlining. It's very strong facts with that DNA in particular and Mr. Harris's flight. As well as the movement in the car. But there, the court still found it insufficient because there was a rational inference that Mr. Harris simply wasn't the one who exercised dominion and control over that firearm.
Well, you know, I mean, I think the state points out that in that case, there weren't any movements that they could see of Mr. Harris like we had here, where at least here in the back seat, he was moving around there. So does that distinction in the case make a difference?
It does not. The Harris case is actually pretty clear that everyone was moving in the car. That would include Mr. Harris. The Supreme Court's distinction of the movement itself is more particularized to the fact that the officers did not articulate that the movement was towards the firearm up in the headlining of the vehicle. Nothing to negate the fact that Mr. Harris was in fact one of the individuals moving around in that car. The way they,
I mean, here we have him moving in the direction of the item.
I respectfully disagree with the characterization of that. The officer is very clear that he reached down and to the left, and this zipper pouch, the manicure kit that is found that contains the methamphetamine, is described as being underneath his seat. That would be directly underneath you, not down and to the left. The state seems to think that there's no difference between, you know, left and underneath, but I believe officers are more particular when they describe what they're seeing. And he says down and to the left. You can almost see it. It's very difficult in the squad video. You can see a bit of movement with a shadow of his head. And again, the rational inference there is that he grabs the beer that we know he then drinks. I mean, the beer did not materialize in his hand. He had to obtain it from somewhere. And later on, when the officers are doing the inventory search of the various items in the vehicle, they find in the Hot Topic bag several unopened cans of Bud Light. And there were open cans in the vehicle when they looked through it. So with that rational inference of, you know, why does he reach down to the left? I mean, if the state's theory is it's at the drugs, I think it's a little bit of a stretch to say down and to the left is underneath your seat. But even this gets to Judge Flory's comment, is that even if that is consistent with guilt, a very much more rational inference from that is that he grabbed a beer. And it doesn't need to be more or less rational, because we don't defer to the rational inferences made by the fact finder. He grabbed a beer, he drank it.
What do you make of the, you know, the fact that his key and a knife were found in that part of the car? Or do you find, is that another thing that he could have been doing, or you're focusing kind of on the beer in the bag?
Yeah, and I point that out in my brief too. I mean, that's just another rational hypothesis. He, you know, the state seemed to be the ones at trial saying that this Ford key belonged to his truck. And then there was a knife down there, both of which he could have been ditching, not wanting a knife on his person as he's about to get arrested, or wanting his vehicle to be moved. We knew it was parked on the street when they were observing him earlier that morning. Totally rational inferences to be made about that down and to the left movement. And does not necessarily, it does not negate, you know, I mean, I think that's the point. That's Sam brings this up quite clearly when they go through the circumstances proved. They clearly draw out that there is a rational inference that in Sam, the drugs and the firearm were already in the vehicle prior to Sam ever driving it, or that the passenger was the one who was exercising dominion and control. And there was nothing about the circumstances that negated those inferences, nothing that objectively says, no, that is false. You know, things like the down and to the left movement would be, I think, far more incriminating if he wasn't drinking a beer, if they didn't find his key or some other item that he might have thrown on that left, the driver's side floorboard behind him. But that's just not the case here. We have rational inferences that are consistent with innocence, inconsistent with guilt. And that is an insufficient evidence. I mean, it's not an overly complicated case, particularly when you look at Sam. Towards the end of Sam, after they make the findings of having no exclusion of rational inferences, the Sam court specifically notes what usually gets the state past the field goal, so to speak, which gets them in the end zone and actually gets that guilty verdict. They note things like items being found in the defendant's own home, demonstrating more exercising of dominion or control over those items, or effects identifying the defendant being on or near the incriminating items found. Or simply an admission by the defendant about the item found, and that there was no testimony in Sam or that there was at some point the defendant actually possessing those items. Those are the circumstances proved that typically get a sufficient guilty verdict.
Well, the state points out that he had conceded or admitted to having used methamphetamine earlier that day. What do you make of that factor? Why isn't that then, you know, similar to the evidence you were just talking about of knowing that he at least had been in possession in some form of meth earlier that day?
Well, so I would note, first of all, he does say it was earlier that morning that he used methamphetamine. You know, to simply infer that then he must have possessed the methamphetamine beneath him would be a very clear violation of 404B, arguing that he's acting in conformity with some conduct there. But it's the appropriate use is actually what the district court uses it for, which is it can be used to show knowledge. He can't then claim, oh, I didn't know it was methamphetamine. I thought it was sugar. I thought it was flour or something like that. And the district court does find it not with respect to the constructive possession element, but with respect to the knowing, whether or not he knew the substance was a controlled substance. And it can be used for that. Had the court found it, as a conduct in conformity, that would have been a separate issue to raise before this court even. Given those circumstances, we would ask that you reverse his conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Foss, you have 15 minutes.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Pamela Foss, and I represent the respondent in this case, the state of Minnesota, on behalf of Mr. Melton, who was the attorney that tried this case as well as wrote the brief, but was unavailable today for argument. I think in this case, we have a unique situation where it's not just a jury verdict, but it's a court verdict, which outlines specific findings of fact based on the evidence that was presented at trial. And the defense in their brief and their argument today goes stretches beyond what evidence was actually presented at trial. There was a video that the court saw, the officers testified. The appellant tries to make a big deal about reaching down into the left, and that could only be the rational inferences to grab a beer out of a bag. He also argues that that's not the appellant's bag. It's the individual in the front passenger seat's luggage. But I think what we have here is a case of a judge who meticulously made her findings of fact, looked at the evidence, didn't make any guesses or any assumptions that were outside the evidence. We have an individual who was over a minute and a half making furtive movements in the car while law enforcement was trying to get him out of the car. We have the driver who testified that said it was not her methamphetamine and she was not aware of any drugs that were in the car. We have
Ms. Foss, can I ask you, when you referred the district court judge, as I asked Mr. Monins, it appears to me that the judge did what a district court fact finder would do as a jury and really, by implication or by result, only addressed the first step in the heightened standard. And so that's why I understand Mr. Monin's client is not disagreeing essentially with the verdict pursuant to the first step that there is a rational inference of guilt. But I guess my question is, and I didn't see it in Mr. Melton's briefing, how about the specific facts that they argue is a rational inference other than guilt? And so you referenced a couple, that leaning down into the left and his Ford F-150 keys are there. You have the driver saying that the passenger reached to the back right at the time of the stop. And then she identifies the bags in the back, which also had drug paraphernalia items belonging to the passenger. And I think there was evidence that everyone had reach to the little pouch. So what about those facts do not create, in your opinion, a rational hypothesis other than guilt?
Well, and I guess in starting with, I don't, and again, I wasn't at the trial, but from my understanding of the placement of the people in the vehicle and the type of vehicle, I don't think that it was found that everybody had access to where that little pouch was found. And the little pouch was described by the court to be one that could have been in the jacket of the appellant when he entered the car. So, I mean, there's always in any case going to be other guesses that people could make, because we don't have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. But we have a defendant who has a small package of methamphetamine. He said he had used methamphetamine earlier in the day. It's at his feet where he has reached down towards when the officer stopped, along with other property of his, the key, a knife. The evidence was sufficient to find him guilty. The idea that any guilt or any other inference would negate that guilt, I think based on the facts that the court had and the admissions by the defendant, the testimony of the witnesses, where that package was found, would show that he had constructive possession of that. He had access to it. It was his methamphetamine that he brought into the car.
Ms. Floss?
Go ahead, please, Judge Floyd.
Yeah.
Sorry, you're muted now, Judge.
There we go. I think the question is, why isn't it a rational hypothesis other than guilt that those drugs were already in the car when Mr. Torres got in, considering the fact that, as I understand the record, there was nothing about that little pouch or the drugs themselves that link them directly to him, such as the lack of DNA evidence, the lack of fingerprinting, anything like that that wasn't done in the case. I mean, why isn't it a rational explanation that they were already in the car when he got in?
It's my understanding that the driver of the car testified that there was no drugs in the car. I mean, I don't...
But there is evidence. I mean, that we also know that not to be true, because the backpack had meth in it, the backpack that were sitting right next to him, but those have been attributed to the passenger. So we know that there were other bags that had methamphetamine in the car, but it's just that those had been attributed to the other passenger, right?
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. I'm just, and I understand, you know, as a former district court judge, I probably would have came to this same decision based on this evidence at a bench trial. But now on appeal, we're looking at whether there's other rational explanations for how those drugs could have gotten there and whether they're, you know, whether they're reasonable and whether they can be ruled out. And I think that's what we're struggling with here. Law enforcement could have made this an easier case had they done further investigation, but we don't have that. And I think that's something that we seem to be struggling with here a little bit.
Yeah, and I can't speak to the investigation. I mean, we would obviously, yes, they could have done some testing. They didn't do that. I just think the circumstances that were proved and were looked at by the court, we have someone admitted to using methamphetamine, a small package within his reach at his feet where he was reaching to, was sufficient for the court to find him guilty. And I guess as far as other rational inferences, there are other rational inferences, but I don't think that it amounts to a reversal in this case. And I don't have anything other than essentially relying on Mr. Melton's brief and the record that the court has, the exhibits that I believe have been transferred to the court, which include the video of the stop. So if there's no further questions for myself, I would then cede my time to the appellant.
Doesn't appear to be any other questions. So thank you so much for your time. Mr. Monin, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I'd like to start by addressing Judge Flory's question about nothing in the pouch linking it to Mr. Torres. And I think that's a very crucial observation in this case, particularly when we have the facts and circumstances that do seem to link that nail clipper pouch to the front passenger. I mean,
let me stop you a second, Mr. Mullen. You've made that claim a couple times in your brief, and quite frankly, I struggle with it because I don't see anything in the record other than male toiletries that seem to connect these two. There's nothing that suggests that the pouch is the same label, same brand, same anything. So how can we say that when, you know, the judge found that it's a pouch capable of being concealed? Clearly law enforcement could have done more here. There's no question about that. Maybe it would have shown something, maybe it wouldn't have. So, you know, I grant you that, but I, you know, I struggled with that statement, and I think it was at two places in your brief that they were likely associated and without a citation to the record supporting that.
So the association is not a circumstance proved. I want to be clear about that. It is an
Right.
inference, right? I mean, I'm saying it's an inference about the evidence. The evidence here is you have approximately, it's about 4 inches long, 2 or 3 inches wide, nail clipper pouch. It's a manicure kit. It is the type of thing that you would have in a, for instance, travel dop kit. In that bag, in the Nike bag, there is a dop kit with a shaving kit, with deodorant, with toothpaste. These are all the type of toiletries you would also find with like a nail clipper pouch. Our point is just that the inference can be made that there is an association between the fact that the front passenger, Mr. Darcy, seems to have several bags of personal items in this car. The bags contain clothing, they contain toiletries and hygiene products, and he says he's moving to Zimmerman in a few hours. That all those
But they all
circumstances, I
but they
think.
also contain paraphernalia, scales, drug-related information, including drugs, methamphetamine, that he didn't take the time to hide when he got into the car and threw his bags in there. But now there's a package or a little pouch containing this methamphetamine directly under your client. I don't know. I don't think you can have it both ways. It seems to me if the assumption or the inferences is that this is Mr. Darcy's drugs and he put them under the seat when he got into the car, but he didn't bother to hide all of his other incriminating information in his bags. It doesn't seem to make sense to me.
Well, I think there's two different hypotheses here consistent with innocence. The first being that it was somehow underneath the seat before Mr. Torres got in. And I don't think they have circumstances to negate that. But the other
Right.
fact is that Ms. Artley, the driver, does say that Mr. Darcy makes a motion behind him after they get stopped. You could have here, I mean, we have the methamphetamine paraphernalia in the one bag. So it's again totally rational that Mr. Darcy has actual methamphetamine to go with his paraphernalia, his tube and pipe and everything else. And then when they get pulled over, totally rational that he just throws it behind him to get it underneath the seat. And Mr. Torres can't be convicted. Possession has to require more than someone throwing something at your feet. So I think there's kind of two competing theories. I'm not trying to have it both ways. I'm just saying, I mean, frankly, there's just a lot of circumstances here that are inconsistent with guilt. I mean, that's the state's problem. They didn't eliminate these facts when they presented their evidence. And the state seems to acknowledge that, saying that there are inferences, but then don't want to acknowledge the level of scrutiny that this court gives to circumstantial evidence cases. They point out, for instance, that Mr. Torres stayed in the car for about a minute and a half. If you watch the squad video in there, Ms. Artley, the driver, takes almost a minute to get out. They stop the car at about 1:20. She gets out about 2:15. The front passenger, Mr. Darcy, gets out just before Mr. Torres. Partly it's these people getting pulled over and they don't know what law enforcement's exactly doing. They're yelling at them to get out. They have guns drawn. They're nervous, right? I mean, it just takes a little bit of time to get out. It's not as though they fled for several minutes or anything like that. Sorry, I just want to make sure I don't have anything. I guess the last thing I would just note is the finding, the discovery of this. Oh, excuse me, my time is up.
Sorry, muted myself. You can finish your sentence and then we'll wrap up.
I did just want to note that the discovery of the pouch, the officer says it was partially open and he sees a baggie. It did require his use of a flashlight to see it. And if you watch the squad video, it takes him approximately 6 minutes to find it. So there again, I think we have a circumstance where it's not an immediate apparent object, and the methamphetamine is inside the pouch, which makes it even less apparent. I think all of these facts show that Mr. Torres did not exercise dominion and control, or at least there's a rational hypothesis that he did not. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case has been submitted, and we will issue an opinion within the time prescribed by statute.